why does Tom take these rings? Why does he take Dickie's ring? And why does he wear it in the second half of the film, even though it could get him into trouble? And you can argue two things, I think, here with the ring. Either he loved Dickie so much that this ring is a token of him and he can't bear to live without it. Or in his mind, he can't fully be Dickie Greenleaf without that ring.
Oh, okay.
Because Dickie always wears that ring. And that's how he's always known Dickie, is wearing that ring. So I used to always think it's because he's obsessed with Dickie, he loves Dickie, that's why he wears the ring. I now think, possibly, it's because he needs it to complete the identity to become Dickie Greenleaf. In late 1950s New York, a young underachiever named Tom Ripley is sent to Italy to retrieve Dickie Greenleaf, a rich and spoiled millionaire playboy. But when the errand fails, Ripley takes extreme measures. Let's get into the iconic film from 1999, The Talented Mr. Ripley.
What is up, movie friends? Welcome back to Raiders of the Lost Podcast, the ultimate film and TV podcast. And today, we are breaking down one of our personal favorite films of all time from Anthony Mangella, The Talented Mr. Ripley, starring Matt Damon, Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, as well as Cate Blanchett and Philip Seymour Hoffman. An incredible cast, an incredible film, and adaptation of the Patricia Highsmith novel. This is one of my most rewatched films. For me, there's something magical about it. I think everybody has films in their lives where they just go back to them over and over again, and not only are they just more revealing, but they bring warmth to you and like increase that love and solidify that love and admiration for cinema. For me, Talented Mr. Ripley is up there. It's one of my most watched, most loved films of all time. When I put it on, I just feel warm and cozy, even though it's about murder.
I was going to say, it's about a serial killer, but that's what makes Anthony feel warm and cozy. I'm just kidding. It's the beautiful landscapes of Italy, incredible cinematography. This is the peak of what cinema can be, in my opinion. This is a perfect movie. It's brilliant. 1999 was a banger of a year, maybe the best year in cinema history. And this is a standout amongst some of the others written and directed by Anthony Mangella on a budget of $40 million. It was a hit at the box office with $128 million gathered globally. It also had 5 Oscar nominations, including Best Supporting Actor for Jude Law, Best Adapted Screenplay.
You got it.
That came out weird. For Anthony Mangella. And then we also have Best Art Direction and Set Direction, which I think now is just production design, right?
Yeah.
And then Best Costume Design and Best Music Original Score from Gabriel Yared, which I agree with because this movie has some incredible themes, iconic. It feels like very much a Bernard Herrmann contemporary score in a lot of ways. I adore The Talented Mr. Ripley, one of my all-time favorite films, one of the most interesting and fascinating characters in fiction of the 20th century from Patricia Highsmith. She wrote a whole series of novels of Ripley. There's a movie from the 1960s on the original book as well. They just made a new show at Netflix called Just Ripley.
Just Ripley.
Drop the Talented Mr.
Drop the Talented Mr. It's cleaner.
It's cleaner. Ripley. Which we haven't checked out yet, but this is a character that's going to keep getting interpretations. There's obviously one that stars John Malkovich. There's one that stars Barry Pepper, which was, I believe,
Ripley's Game, but Ripley Underground,
yes. Which was not a very good adaptation, in my opinion, the one with Barry Pepper.
And speaking of John Malkovich, he's actually been desperate to make that property for years. He was, and then he wanted to make this film, didn't get to be able to sign on to direct it, which he wanted to do. And then he ended up, I think he was just pursuing Patricia Highsmith's work for years until he was able to act in his own.
Yeah, and really what the character that Patricia Highsmith created is so fascinating and standing the test of time. And if you've never read the books, I can't recommend them enough. This movie is a brilliant adaptation. But what Anthony Mangella did with the story is he infused something that gave a lot of energy to the story, to the movie, to something we'd seen before, read plenty of times. He added this great component of jazz music, which is not in the book, but it's one of the main components and motifs of this film. Obviously, we have a great original compositions, but we have great jazz in this film and great music scenes that are not in the book, but it adds a new life to the story.
It adds a lot of flair to the film that it would have been missing, as well as compounding on Dickie's character. And giving Tom another way to get into that world of his orbit. And also, Meredith Logue, played by Cate Blanchett, is not in the novel. So that character was created for this film and actually works out really well especially for the ending of the film, which we'll get into later. But I think Meredith Logue was an incredible addition narrative-wise and really helped complicate things for Tom more so than they were in the actual novel. So I think that those are the two major additions and changes that really helped the film excel and become something really special. And in my opinion, it's leagues apart from any of the other adaptations.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you, Anthony. Now let's set up the story and plot of this magnificent picture. What a picture.
What a picture.
So Tom Ripley is this underachieving, very intelligent, quiet, inquisitive, mysterious young guy in New York City, and he works for a living in these multiple jobs. He's a pianist. He's trying to be a pianist, but he's lower class. You know what I mean? He literally climbs out of his poverty every day just to reach the city streets. He lives next to a butcher shop, and he's so poor. He lives in a basement of an apartment. He literally climbs a ladder just to see the air. You know, it's a great metaphor for his life. And Tom, at a recital at a very exclusive, upper-class, affluent concert, is playing piano, filling in for a friend who hurt his hand, and his friend lends him a jacket. And that's a quote from the movie. I wish I could take it all back. It all started with borrowing a jacket. He borrows a jacket of some guy who went to Princeton, and he's seen by Herbert Greenleaf. And Herbert Greenleaf afterwards obviously approaches him and asks him, because Tom immediately lies that he went to Princeton as well, because Herbert's son, Dickie Greenleaf, went to Princeton. He asks him, will you go to Italy to retrieve my son, who's been there for years, just squandering his wealth, doing whatever, being a playboy, spending all his time on the beach, sailing, spending his inheritance. Will you go persuade him to come home? And that's the plot of the film, is Tom Ripley going to Italy to try to bring somebody he's never met before, somebody he has to pretend he knows, home from Europe for Herbert Greenleaf.
And climbing the ladder is a great metaphor for the character, because he has this innate ability to move up the hierarchy of the social structure of any society. And it has to do with his incredible talent for lies, for forgery, for impersonation. And Tom Ripley is defined by his ability to lie. And also it's an impulsive thing, his lying. And the film starts, and it's so good when your character starts the story. Tom starts the story by lying about knowing Dickie. And it's when Mr. Greenleaf asks, oh, did you know our son Dickie? A normal person would say, oh, no, I never went to Princeton. But Tom, with really no reason, he just likes to lie. He says, oh, yeah, how is Dickie?
Doesn't even say, yes, I went.
Yeah, he just says, how is Dickie? And so he begins the story. That's the catalyst for everything. Everything that unfolds in this film is because Tom lied to Greenleaf. Because then Greenleaf thinks, oh, I can ask this guy who went to school with my son to go try and get him in Italy and bring him back home. So it's such a powerful storytelling device when your character is driving the story forward. And also has an incredible opening. This has a bookend opening and ending, essentially, The Talented Mr. Ripley. So the first shot we see is the second to last shot that we see in the film. It does end with a much stronger image. In my opinion, it's one of my favorite closing shots of all time. But the film opens with this great pan around tracking of Tom sitting inside of the room of a boat. And we get that with this ominous music pouring in. And then we get to see that it was the little recital they're doing at the party. But this bookend opening shot is actually the very end of the film. And I thought it was a smart way to showcase the dark path this character is about to go on. And how I will say the final shot of the film is by far the most incredible shot of this film and one of my all-time favorite shots of all time. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah, the final shot in the mirror. But also the opening shot with the bookend, it's really brilliant with this cool black and white graphic. It looks like shards of broken glass coming in, which goes into the next scene. It's got great opening title credits where we're seeing cinematography of live action, but then we have some cool colored bars as well as great font. A great title sequence too, where we have the talented Mr. Ripley coming into play, but the talented's red font, but then it changes to different adjectives with different colors until it ends on the talented and it zooms forward. It's really beautiful. And I love Tom Ripley as a character. I'm very drawn to him in the novels as well as this film specifically. He's very intelligent, like we've been talking about. He's attractive. He's very quiet, but he's a fast learner. He's quick on his feet.
You're a quick study, aren't you?
Yeah, Freddie Miles says, you're a quick study, aren't
you? Last time you didn't know your ass from your elbow, and now you're giving me directions.
That's not fair. I'm sure you know your ass from your elbow. He's very adaptable, too. He can adapt to different situations if he's never been in them before. He's also very mysterious. He never, ever reveals personal information about him. That's the truth. Until maybe with Peter a little bit, he says one of those lines where one of the ending lines of this film, which is really beautiful and poignant and very much a confession of the character, where he says, mm-hmm. I always thought it would be better to be a pretend somebody than
A fake somebody instead of a real nobody.
Exactly. That's a confession of Tom Ripley, how he really feels on the inside.
I also think that, to tie that, I do think he tells Dickie some bit of truth, and it's, I think he tells the truth to people, and essentially men that he's extremely infatuated with. And so he, the first thing he, Dickie asks him is, what's your talent?
True.
And then Tom says, I'm lying, forgery, impersonating basically anybody. He's not lying about that. And it is a ploy to get him to reveal what he's really doing there, Tom. But he did actually tell the truth to Dickie immediately.
He's also, in addition to that couple times he does tell the truth, mm-hmm. he's a brilliant liar. But his style of lying, it's expert level. And it always makes me wonder, I always like to think, how long has Tom been like this? Has he always been a liar like this? Has he always been sort of a sociopath? Has he ever killed anyone before he met Dickie? I would say that maybe he's never killed anyone before Dickie, but he's probably been lying for his entire life. And
I agree.
He's a brilliant liar, because what he does is, a lot of times he'll tell straight up lies, but he'll often let the people he's lying to or conning, he'll let them cover his lies for him.
Fill in the blanks.
They'll do the information. They'll do the lie for him. For example, when, obviously we're spoiling this movie now because you've all seen The Talented Mr. Ripley. After he's killed Dickie and he's talking to Marge, and Marge has read the letter about Dickie, and Dickie says that he's moving to Rome. This is all a con, because he's constantly conning people. He cons Herbert Greenleaf. He cons Dickie the entire time, and Marge. And Marge can't believe it, and she's like, I should go confront him. And then Tom doesn't say anything. He lets people do the talking. Same thing with Herbert. He doesn't say, oh, I went to Princeton. He just says, oh, how's Dickie? He lets them do the talking to get into situations. And Marge says he doesn't like to be confronted, and he says, I think you're right. He's lying. He's conning, but he didn't respond to her. He lets the other people he's lying to and conning kind of work out things for him in a lot of ways, because even though he's a serial killer, he's a sociopath, he's a con man, he's a liar, he's incredibly lucky as well.
I think that Tom has been lying all of his life, and he's always been an expert liar, probably ever since childhood, with whatever his childhood was like. And you can tell he did not have a happy one or a privileged one, obviously, because he comes from nothing. However, so there's really a really cool thing about the film in terms of Gabriel Yared's music, and he has the xylophone instrument, this really cool theme play every time he lies. And so when you watch this film again, every time Tom tells a little white lie, especially in the first half of the film, you hear the xylophone theme.
Oh, like the...
Yep. That happens.
Bum, 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 bum. So that part, yeah?
The xylophone...
Yeah.
That happens every time he lies in the first half.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's a really... It's him being mischievous and
it's
having
playful.
Fun. Yes. And so that theme is actually called Mischief. So if you watch the film again, listen for that theme. It plays every time he tells a little white lie. And so I think that Tom, he's an expert level liar. I don't think he's ever gotten into anything serious yet. This is obviously the first book in her series. This is the first time he's gotten into very dangerous events and very high profile communities, because in other films, he kind of weaves himself almost innately and kind of like out of his control. Sometimes he just finds himself into these circles of high class people, very important people, and he gets into their worlds and their orbits. And,
yeah.
And it's because of his lying, and there's two ways Tom lies. He lies because he's trying to get out of a situation, or because he wants something, or he'll lie because he's an impulsive liar and he can't help it. So like I said earlier, the Herbert Greenleaf lie, he just did it. But then throughout the course of the film, he starts lying because it'll benefit him or get him out of a sitch. So another time he lies just for the fun of it, I think, is when he first meets Meredith out after they the ship arrives in Italy, and they both meet each other looking for their luggage and waiting to go. She asks him who he is, and he says he's Dickie Greenleaf. He doesn't know if he's ever going to meet this person again. Why doesn't he just say he's Tom Ripley? I think he just lies just because he can't help it sometimes. And there are times when that benefits him, like with Meredith, knowing her and her knowing him as Dickie ended up helping him in the end with this story. But then sometimes it can work to his disadvantage, where making that little white lie didn't work. So on top of that, he's a master improviser. And what I love about this film is it's not like other films where manipulators and impulsive liars or grifters, people who are trying to make money off of lies, is a grifter. They have a huge plan and they're exercising everything to the T, and everything's very specific, every minute detail. Saltburn's an example of that, where Barry Keoghan's character Oliver had this very precise plan, and everything had to fall into order the perfect way for it to work out. The thing with Tom Ripley, especially in this film, is he doesn't have a plan. He's winging it as he's going along, and he's taking it basically step by step. And that causes him to have to improvise and think on his feet. And he gets into some very dicey situations, but it's his incredible ability to lie, which helps him get out of every problem.
I'm going to disagree with you on one thing about the lying. I don't think he lies out of enjoyment. I think that he lies because he doesn't like who he is. He doesn't like the way he grew up. Obviously, he's very liking the things that happened to him. Mm-hmm. Of course, like, he's wildly lucky, especially if you know the ending of the movie. But Tom is someone who's not born to privilege. He's born into poverty. If you think about who he is, maybe he's an orphan. You know, he kind of fits that bill. He doesn't seem like he has any family or any connections back in America. He works as a butler inside of a bathroom at a concert hall. You know what I mean? That's what he does. He's a third-class mooch. That's what Dickie calls him. That's what he is.
Who are you to me?
And I think a great example of... I think he lies because he wants to be somebody else. He wants to be somebody important.
You're saying he rejects himself.
Exactly. Yeah. I think he wants to... It's both a rejection of his past and who he is, as well as to escape it, because there's a great, I think, metaphor for Tom and his real life versus what he wants to become. It's before he embarks from New York City, and he's studying jazz because he knows Dickie likes jazz. He's very smart. He understood what... He basically was taking notes of what Herbert told him about Dickie. Jazz, it's uncontrollable music. It's just sounds. And Dickie, Tom, what's he do? He starts studying jazz to be really intelligent and well-versed in jazz so he can use it as a non sequitur or a conversation starter for when he eventually meets Dickie. So in this opening sequence in his basement apartment, of his crappy living situation, he's listening to jazz, trying to figure out what's happening above him. There's a fight between a couple, slamming, and what's Tom do? He reacts, and he pretends it's there for a second, but then he goes into his phase where it's gone. I'm ignoring it completely. I think that's a metaphor for Tom's entire life. He's always lived with that kind of background noise in his life, whether it's pain, trauma, growing up in an orphanage possibly, maybe abusive parents. Mm-hmm. He's always wanted a way to escape, and his way to escape is creating other identities or pretending to, not creating identities yet, maybe he hasn't gone that far yet, but pretending to be somebody else. Here he's doing work to try to be somebody he's not. He's learning jazz. He doesn't even know jazz. He doesn't understand jazz. He doesn't like jazz. But I think that's an example that his lying is to escape his life, to be somebody he wants to be somebody he wants. Because wealth and poverty, privilege, that's a massive theme for Tom Ripley in this film. And like I said, he legit climbs out of his poverty to leave his apartment every day.
That's a great point. And I think actually, especially in the first half of the film, Tom is, I wouldn't call him morally good completely, but he does strike me as someone who's, he seems to be good, decent, hardworking, and he seems to mean well.
Yeah, it's like I've been busting my ass because I think it's the right thing to do. Maybe I'll get ahead at some point, but it's not working out.
But he has the potential to be monstrous, and we see that in this film. He has that inside of him, but it's kind of brought out of him based upon the course of events that the story takes place, and he gets himself in these situations where, in his eyes, killing someone is the only way for me to get out of this. And so he does, when he does encounter those moments, he does prove himself to be murderous, but I wouldn't say he's not like a serial killer. He's not like Hannibal Lecter, but he's capable of killing, and he's capable of moving past killing someone's life. So he does have that psychopathy to him where he doesn't really feel guilty too much about killing people. He doesn't feel guilty about Freddy. He doesn't feel guilty about Dickie really, especially in the end of the film where he's basically becoming Dickie.
I think that's why he doesn't feel guilty
exactly,
anymore.
Exactly, yeah. So he does have this thing where in the first half of the film, and it's a transformation. He didn't know he was capable of this until it was there. It's not like he was a murderer before the film started. So
I agree.
I think that in the first half of the film, he was just a guy just trying to do the best he could to get by. And he had very tasteful aspirations. There's great moments in the first act before the journey where, you know, even though he comes from nothing, he likes to surround himself with high class. I'm sure he chose to work at that opera house in the bathroom. He could be a janitor or not a janitor. I'm thinking Goodwill Hunting.
He could be a janitor at MIT. You could be solving equations on walls. He could have done that, guys.
He could have been the bathroom attendant in probably any other bathroom.
In a movie theater.
And yeah, anywhere. But he chose to do it in an opera house because it surrounds him with high society. He chose to be a piano tuner because he loves piano, and he connects playing piano with high class. So he has this appetite.
Especially in that era, it was.
Yes, absolutely. He has this appetite for high society. He has this appetite for wealth and class and style. He just can't afford any of it, and he's not allowed in any of the circles. He's a nobody. And so this is why when he meets Dickie, he's found a way in. He's finally found a way to get into that class, to get into that society, in a place where he'll end up thriving in later novels. He does thrive in high class. He fits in well, even though nobody really knows he's a true outsider, because he can blend in, and he's suited to that. He loves classical music. He loves tasteful. He has that bourgeois style. So he has the culture. He just doesn't have the class status.
True. A corduroy jacket in Italy.
I
was just saying.
And well, I love the journey to Italy.
Yeah, I think one of the greatest strengths of this movie is the structure. And within 5 minutes and 20 seconds, we have the plot and motivation. By 5:20, Dickie's father, Herbert, asks Tom to go to Italy to bring his son home from Europe to America.
Yeah.
Within 5 minutes, it's so effective. It's engaging.
And we know so much about Tom in 5 minutes.
Yeah, like this movie's done so well. We have so much characterization, but we get the plot right away. That's it. We don't waste time because it's a long movie. It's over 2 hours. And I think it's really important to get the motivation for the character and get also the plot going really quickly, because the rest of this movie's in Italy, and it's fantastic and it's beautiful. And that's one of the greatest strengths of the movie is the production design, the exteriors, the locations. Obviously, they filmed at a lot of the same locations in Italy. If you've ever been, you'll recognize many scenes or just different shots or angles of like the Spanish Steps or some different areas of local parts in Rome. They just made use of those locations really well. But it's still beautiful. I mean, you couldn't film a movie like this today because
no way.
Tourism has boomed so much just in the last 20 years, especially in Italy.
The Spanish Steps are so empty.
You can do Spanish Steps, but it has to be something very specific, and it seems like only at nighttime. Like The Man from U.N.C.L.E., they have a scene on the Spanish Steps, but it's at night. They probably filmed that at like 4 a.m., you know what I mean? But to film in so many exteriors in Rome or in Venice, in these massively popular locations for tourism, it'd be impossible right now, because I think, and that's one of my favorite draws to this movie, is I've been to Italy twice, and whenever I watch this movie, it feels like I'm back there. And I think they did a brilliant job capturing minimal tourism, but also the era, the wardrobe, the production design, the cars, the style. It's just, it's chef's kiss. It's done so goddamn well.
I think of one of the reasons why I love this film so much is because the lifestyle is so intoxicating. The 1950s, 1960s Italy, it just sounds like an amazing place to live, an amazing time to be.
If you have money,
If you have money, especially. So I think for me, there is an allure. I think the audience gets just as allured to Dickie in his life as Tom does.
100%, because Jude Law is terrific as Dickie Greenleaf. He's so personable. Golden God, hair god, Jude Law kills this role. Oscar-nominated performance. But even though Dickie's a prat, he's this upper-class asshole, he's had a silver spoon up his butt his entire life, he's still so charming and so intoxicating. You can't take your eyes off him on the screen. I think that characters like this have disappeared from cinema and from television, because usually I think it's a lot lazier writing these days to just put one character trait on a person, and that's who they are. Like, I haven't watched the Ripley film, the new Ripley show, but I'm assuming Dickie's less charismatic and less charming for the audience than this version of it. But this version of the character played by Jude Law is so incredible. Like, you fall in love with Dickie Greenleaf just like Tom Ripley falls in love with Dickie Greenleaf.
That's what really makes the film work, and it's that intoxicating quality that Jude, first of all, brings with his performance, and then
his face and that tan
and the life he lives off his income off his trust. The man doesn't have to work. He just gets to sail around, eat great food, sleep with Italian women, and then party and play bocce. Like, that sounds just like heaven. It's just an amazing life. And not only is Tom intoxicated by that, but the audience is intoxicated by that. And they did an amazing job of so this film has like four chapters: the opening chapter, then the seduction chapter, the falling in love with the world that Tom has, and then we have evading investigation and police, and then the escape chapter. So there's like four main chapters of this story, and this is just...
Well, I would say... Hold on, say those chapters again.
So the setup, opening.
Yep.
And then the intoxication and seduction of Italy and Dickie.
Yeah.
And then avoiding investigation.
Well, the murder and avoiding investigation. Murder, but that's the combined with becoming Dickie Greenleaf.
Becoming Dickie, yeah, absolutely.
That's a chapter.
Yeah, and then escaping investigation for the finale.
Leaving Dickie behind. Yeah,
exactly. Leaving him behind. So, and Tom goes through immense transformation. And so, but the, like you said, this film could never be made like this again because the locations, it's just too overpopulated. And it's just, we see films shot in Italy, but it's still, there's crowds everywhere. There's really no way to pull this off.
You can do it in the slow months. You can do it January, February. Yeah. Haunting in Venice had some solid locations for Italy on this scale, filming seven scenes at the Spanish Steps during broad daylight, not going to happen.
And they actually use, so I have a lot of information about the locations because I think that the production did an amazing job using stunning locations. So the film takes place mostly when it's in Italy, mostly in Mangibello, which is actually a fictional town written for the book.
Mangibello!
Which just means eat beautiful. however, Naples actually stood in for most of Mangibello. So Naples, there's a couple of islands off the coast, and they filmed much of those sequences in Naples. So
that's right. We were on a ferry that we...
Exactly, yeah.
We went past them a few times.
And then you drive across these small islands to get to Sicily. Most of the streets that you see in Dickie's neighborhood, these are all in Naples, actually. And much of what happened in Mangibello takes place in Naples. Next up, Venice was obviously used famously for where Peter Smith Kingsley lives.
Have you met Peter Smith Kingsley? He's wonderful.
He's wonderful. Terrific third act, and they made great use of that huge piazza that everybody goes to, and this is where he meets Greenleaf with Marge. Rome, obviously, is used quite a bit in this film. Some of the main iconic landmarks, but that jazz club actually does exist in Rome, although it's not a jazz club. They fixed it up and made it look like a jazz club. Some of the Rome interiors are actually set in Rome, and a couple of the interiors that they shot for where Dickie and Marge live was in Rome as well. Obviously, the Spanish Steps was used quite a bit. They used it twice in two major scenes, and they actually changed all the cafe storefronts so that it looks different for the audience.
They actually used it three times.
Oh, wow, three times.
So you're thinking of the cafe scene, obviously.
Cafe Danelli.
As well as when Tom is with...
Marge.
Marge.
Meredith shopping. Yes.
He's with Meredith twice at the Spanish Steps. They make it look like they're entering the Spanish Steps piazza, but then they have a shot where they're coming down the stairs.
Walking down the stairs.
So those are the stairs of the side of the Spanish Steps. There's a staircase on the side.
Thank you. Three scenes.
Gotcha.
Three scenes.
And next says, when you grow up with money, you grow up, you have it, and you hate it.
You can only get along with people who also have it and hate it.
I've never admitted that to anybody.
I know exactly what you mean. So where the bus actually lets Tom off is in Naples at Ischia Ponte. And this is a little square right off the seafront. This is where he's let off the bus and those two men are singing. And it's just an amazing shot. It's a beautiful romanticizing image of the Italian waterside. Naples was used, for most of the street scenes. The ceremony in Silvana's death, that religious ceremony, and then when Silvana is discovered drowned, that's Ischia Island, just off of Naples. Positano and Salerno were also used for a few things. Positano for one of the beach scenes. The Galleria Principe in Naples, which is that huge ornate glass ceiling that they go when they pick up letters and mail. That's in Naples as well. The Piazza Navona is very famous. If you travel to Rome, you'll probably go there for one of the most common sights. That's where Tom and Dickie are eating lunch, waiting for Freddy to show up. And Freddy drives his car right through the piazza. And then Palazzo...
Arrivederci!
Arrivederci!
Ciao bello!
And the Palazzo Taverna is an old historical hotel that they used for all of Tom Ripley's apartment interiors, the Dickie interiors that Tom bought as Dickie. And actually, a couple of the other scenes for interiors were used at this same famous hotel, the Palazzo Taverna.
Wow, thanks for bringing that information out.
And they shot, originally, most of the New York scenes in Italy, in Rome, but didn't look good. So then they actually ended up shooting it in New York City, New York scenes.
Yeah, I think you can try your best to make one country look like another, but at the end of the day, New York is New York, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
On the harbor with the ships and everything like that. And it's a great shot when they're playing the little concert with the skyline in the background. It's really terrific. Yeah. They use a great long lens to crush that depth of field. It feels like it's right behind them. It's a beautiful image. Now, let's get to Dickie Greenleaf.
Dickie
is such a great character. I think it might be Jude Law's best performance. And like Ailey said, immediately when Tom sees Dickie, he clearly is falling in love with him. He's becoming infatuated with him. He becomes obsessed with him. He's doing impressions of him. Even when he's looking through the binoculars and he sees the boat is called Bird, him and Marge jumping off of it, he's focusing completely on Dickie, and he says the lines in Italian, "This is my face," while he's looking at Dickie. So he's obviously, it's a great little nod to he wishes he was Dickie Greenleaf, probably. At this point, he's probably, "I wish I was this guy." He is living the best life, like Andy said. He's living this incredible life of luxury in one of the most beautiful places in the world. "This is my face." It's a great foreshadow of how it becomes his face when he eventually steals his identity, basically, later on after murdering him.
"Questa è la mia faccia."
"Questa la mia faccia."
He does look at Marge at first, but it's when he's saying, "This is my fiance."
Yeah.
"Questa è la mia fidanzante." Yeah. But he does say, that's a great correlation. It's kind of hinting at, it's a foreshadow of him basically stealing Dickie's face, stealing his persona. And they did that 100% on purpose.
Yeah. And Dickie, like Marge says it to Tom on the yacht, everyone loves Dickie. And Dickie, he kind of collects friends, or he collects people that entertain him for short periods of time. He seems like someone who bounces on from friend to friend to friend to friend. And when you have his attention, like Marge says, it's like the sun's shining on you. But then when he forgets you, it becomes very cold. But that's why everyone loves him, because when you have his attention, you feel like the only person in the entire world, because Dickie is that much of a presence to be around when you have his attention. And it seems like his whole life he's gone through this. You know, Freddie was clearly somebody that that Dickie clearly had a great relationship with. He still does. You know, Freddie comes and visits
him. We can tell Freddie's been missing it.
Yes, exactly, because he immediately distrusts Tom. I mean, the first thing, oh, hey.
He's standoffish.
Nice to meet, finally. And then in the jazz little club, not the jazz club, the record store, when he's telling, they're kind of fighting over attention from Dickie.
Yes, exactly.
They're going back and forth. Tom was supposed to go to the Dickie in Rome and sightsee, but now Freddie's here. They went to lunch. They're in the jazz store looking, listening to records. And the way that Freddie looks at Tom when they're looking at the record, Freddie can clearly, you know what's going through his
mind.
He's
like, back the fuck off.
He's jealous. He also sees Tom as a threat, not just to his time with Dickie and also his relationship with Dickie, but he also sees, I think he sees Tom for exactly what he is. Obviously, the corduroy joke example of that is as well. He sees Tom as a third-class mooch, just like Dickie does. But Dickie, and we'll talk about why he keeps Tom around for so long, Dickie eventually admits that as well on the boat before he gets killed. Yeah. That they both see through Tom and what he really is. But because Dickie gets so drawn to people for short periods of time, plus you can argue that Dickie's really only interested in letting Tom stay there for so long because they're conning his dad. Herbert's sending Tom money.
Yeah.
So that's why Dickie's like, oh, we can be best friends. He'll stay here. He makes me laugh. He does. He likes Tom. But as soon as the money runs out, what happens? He ends the vacation. He says, we'll do one last trip. We'll go to San Remo. And that's it. We'll cut ties. Because why? Tom's run out of money.
And also, it's not just the money, but like you said earlier, Dickie, he goes from person to person. Dickie's defined by his desire for and need for validation. And it's kind of as if he's addicted to just the courtship phase of relationships and even friendships. So when someone's new, and Marge hints pretty much at this, when someone new comes into Dickie's life, he puts everything into them. He puts all of his energy and attention into them because they reciprocated tenfold, because people find themselves incredibly drawn to him and in a way obsessed and infatuated with Dickie. And he likes the attention. Dickie likes being loved. Dickie likes being watched. He doesn't mind. He knows Tom watches him when he's naked. He knows that Tom is just like head over heels ogling him sometimes, but Dickie likes that. However,
Yeah, the way he looks in the mirror.
Exactly.
The bathtub scene in general.
That's absolutely definitive of, like, Dickie knows Tom's ogling him, but he's like, I don't mind it. I like being desired, even if it's by someone I would never be with.
That's a good point.
And so what happens is, and this could happen with courtships, which is why people break up and relationships don't always work out. After the courtship phase, after the fun, you're stuck with the person. Then the fun's over, but, like, how much do you like the person, really? And what happens with Dickie is he gets bored of people. Once he gets to truly know them, he's like, oh, they're not as fun or exciting as they were a month ago when they first got here.
Needs a break. Yeah. Like when Freddie comes, he's like, oh, Freddie's in town.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he gets the same way with Freddie.
He's extremely jealous. I mean, he's extremely selfish because you can say he did this with Fausto in Naples.
Yeah.
He and Fausto probably hung out for a month, and then he was like, Fausto, you're actually kind of boring. I'm kind of getting tired of being around you all the time, but I'll come see you in Naples every once in a while when I feel like going to the jazz club. Same thing with Freddie. They probably spent a great couple months in Rome. They do the vacations every once in a while, but I'm sure he and Freddie had a great first, like, hangout for a month, and then he was like, oh, I'm getting kind of sick of Freddie. You're getting me too much. I need to – I'll come see you when I go to Rome. I'll hit you up. And so you can see that, especially in Freddie, like you said, brilliantly pointed out, that Freddie is absolutely threatened by Tom's attention with Dickie. And so he's trying to take it back. And that's why one of the reasons why Freddie immediately does not like Tom and wants nothing to do with him, also because he sees him as an outsider and a mooch. Also, Dickie he sleeps from woman to woman, even though he's with Marge, even though he truly does love Marge. He doesn't bat an eye. He doesn't feel guilty about sleeping with women wherever he goes, or even ogling women everywhere he goes. He's a taker. He's not a giver in relationships. He takes, he takes, he takes. And when you're not giving him enough, he's like, this isn't entertaining enough. Get away from me. I don't want to be with you. He's just a giant, grown-up, spoiled baby. It's essentially, he never developed maturity to empathize with people. And he's never been able to let go of his ego and his vanity.
Except for, you know, when he's with Marge in their moments alone together, like Marge brings up how there's a tenderness, there's a softness when our heads lie on the pillow that no one else gets to see. So I think with Marge, of course, but at the same time, he has a mistress in different cities. He's got Silvana, he's got the girl in Naples at the club. So Dickie, yeah, you're absolutely right, he's a taker. And when it comes to Tom, Marge says that there's something special about Tom with Dickie, you know. After Freddie comes, they're on the yacht. Dickie and Freddie are swimming. He's drowning me! He's drowning me! Really funny sequence. They're just play fighting in the water. And Tom's sad. He's sulking on the yacht by himself. And Marge comes and talks to him and explains, like, this is what it's like with Dickie. And he always gets excited when new people come around, but especially with you. So it seems like Tom might be his favorite new toy he's gotten to play with. But he still gets bored of it, especially when Freddie comes to town. And also, Tom doesn't bring too much to the table outside of the con. He's interesting. He's amusing to Dickie because he doesn't know how to do anything. He doesn't know how to sail. He doesn't know how to ski. He doesn't have wealth. He doesn't know style. He can't afford anything. So I think he looks at Tom sort of as like a pet project. You know, I can kind of mold him how I want in different ways. But also, Tom does have traits that Dickie admires. I'm sure he can play piano. He's a good singer. He understands music. So I think those are things that Dickie, because he's not himself a strong musician, I think that's something that he appreciates and admires about Tom, because it's not like he doesn't like Tom, because I think he likes Tom very much, especially in the beginning.
Yeah.
But a lot of it's because of the fun of conning his dad, in addition to not being duped about the jazz, because Tom eventually, he likes jazz, you know, by the way. I've come to like it, he says. I think that it seems for me also that when Tom comes clean about not going to Princeton and San Remo, and they're like, did you even go to Princeton? I mean that as a compliment. I mean, you have such great taste. And he talks down to Freddie at the time. He's talking about how people, elite people, don't have any taste, but you have taste. Freddie, for example, is a buffoon, basically. And I think that for Tom, that was a big night. And that's why he kind of opened up on the boat about how about, like, if I come back on my own steam, we'll get a place together. I feel like because Tom thought their relationship was ending, which it clearly kind of was, but that night, because he kind of came clean about a lot of things, about not going to Princeton, about not liking jazz originally, he's kind of opening up and putting the wall down of like, oh, I can tell him some truths right now. Maybe this relationship isn't ending. But I think that What did I say at the beginning of that? I lost my train of thought.
You're doing pretty well.
I was doing well. Pretty
well, I'll build on top
of that. Yeah, build on top of that. So pretend like I said something even smarter to end that.
So after his really brilliant manipulation of Dickie by, you know, I'm leaving, but I'll say goodbye, and he drops the vinyl records of some of Dickie's favorite jazz, that bonding and that night in Naples is what solidifies Dickie's desire to have him stay with him in the house. And then after this, we get to see that Tom is becoming much more interested in becoming Dickie than he is in trying to get Dickie to come home. And we get hints of that. And also Tom, he's such a master manipulator. He knows how people work. He knows what makes them tick. So the first major thing that he does is he points out that ring that Dickie always wears.
Exactly right, Anthony.
The green ring that he's always wearing, and he says, that ring is fabulous.
Nope. He says, that ring is superb.
Superb. And we get to, so this is one of my favorite two shots in the film. So we get, it's a close-up of Dickie making coffee, an espresso, and it's a very, very tight close-up of his hand with the espresso cup. And then it cuts to Tom's eyes extremely close-up. It's an amazing cut. We don't see that many super tight close-ups in this film. This is the first major one. Very, very, very tight. You only see his eyes. You don't even see the edges of his face. That's how tight the camera is. And Mangiello and his DP go to this a few times because they're showing that Tom is observing the minute details of everybody. This is what makes him such a great manipulator. This is what makes him such a great liar. He knows that this ring is important because he's noticed that Dickie's never taken it off. He knows that if he points it out, it might get him brownie points, and it does with Marge. Marge is so happy to hear that he pointed that out. And then we get to hear the background of the ring. This is the ring that he ends up keeping as a trophy and also like a token of his remembrance of Dickie after killing him. It's the last thing that he holds on to. And also, later on in that scene, Tom's in Dickie's room, just exploring and looking around. And he hears Marge and Dickie outside. And Dickie's telling her, oh, Tom's going to stay with me for a little while. He'll be fun. I like him. You like everyone. And what does Tom do? He's playing around with Dickie's jewelry. He's putting on a ring. He's looking in the mirror. He's impersonating not just Dickie, but also Marge.
Marge, you like everyone.
You're like everyone. Marge, you like everybody. So he's kind of playing the roles of both people. And this is a very early hint that he's going to eventually try to become this person and live this world. And it's not so much he's trying to impersonate Marge, but I think he enjoys playing the role. So even if he isn't going to impersonate her, he enjoys like pretending he's her.
Dickie's ring is so important in the second half of this film, because after he kills Dickie and he escapes and he runs away and he's starting to build himself becoming Dickie, he makes that debate. Do I take this jewelry? He leaves it in the suitcase, takes it out. Then he's like, last second. He's going to take those corduroy shirts. He takes the corduroy shirts out, but then he ends up taking the jewelry.
Yeah.
Now,
it's knit shirts, not corduroy.
All right, whatever, sorry.
He would never wear corduroy.
You're right. So why does Tom take these rings? Why does he take Dickie's ring, and why does he wear it in the second half of the film, even though it could get him into trouble? It's the one, if he didn't take those possessions, he would have been fine. But wearing the ring gets him in trouble with Marge, especially because Marge is wearing his Dickie's rings, and that leads to the night where he tries to kill Marge. Now, Dickie was so important to Tom, and you can argue two things, I think, here with the ring.
Mm-hmm.
Either he loved Dickie so much that this ring is a token of him and he can't bear to live without it, or in his mind, he can't fully be Dickie Greenleaf without that ring.
Oh, okay.
Because Dickie always wears that ring. And that's how he's always known Dickie is wearing that ring. So I used to always think it's because he's obsessed with Dickie, he loves Dickie, that's why he wears the ring. I now think possibly it's because he needs it to complete the identity to become Dickie Greenleaf.
I think actually, so I've always thought about it as it being a final connection to Dickie, but I do think you're right because Dickie never took it off. And so if you want to be Dickie Greenleaf, you have to wear that ring that he promised to always keep on.
Yeah, the suits, everything else you can do, but I think in Tom's eyes, he's not really Dickie without that ring.
And it's not like there was a scene where he was like looking at the ring longingly, like acting like it was an emotional object.
Exactly.
Of connecting to Dickie. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that I like that idea of it. The ring is part of the costume, just like the hair. He lightens his hair.
Have you done something to your hair?
Have you done something to your hair? Are you trying to ask me something?
I think
I'm
saying it.
Do you want to? Are you trying to say something?
saying it.
And so, just like the hair, just like the clothing, just like the nice apartment, the ring comes just as much into play when you're becoming Dickie as anything else. That's a great point.
Thank you.
I really like that.
I thought of that last time I was watching it for the 13th time this past 2 years.
And I love, there's a really cool thing about Tom and Water. Do you know from the books you remember? I totally forgot about this.
I haven't read this book in a while.
So Tom Ripley is terrified of water.
Afraid of water, yeah.
He's terrified of water. And so ironically, much of the film is shot just on the coast or on islands. And you actually see hints of this character trait throughout the course of the film, especially in the first half when he's constantly near water. So if you look... when he first introduces himself to Marge and Dickie, he runs out onto the water on the beach, but he doesn't really go that deep. He steps just into the very shallow, like up to his ankles, and then he immediately runs away from the water and pretends as though he was hanging out there.
And he has shoes in his hands, too, shoes, like black shoes.
Yeah. Jeez, have you ever seen a guy so pale, so white?
It's a primer.
So this, he doesn't go that close to the water, that deep in water, because he's afraid of it. He also... This is why he doesn't join Freddy and Dickie in the water when they're on the yacht. Obviously, he feels left out, but, you know, Marge says, oh, go in the water. It's so nice. He's like, oh, no, I'm good. It's because he's afraid to go swimming in the water. Also, we get to see this in the big boat scene. Dickie first messes with Tom by shaking the boat, and this freaks Tom out. He's like, stop shaking the boat. Stop shaking the boat. This is because he's really terrified of falling off that boat. This is why during... the sailing scene when I keep wanting to call him Jude, Dickie's like, can you believe it, Marge? Unbelievable. Tom can't ski either. But Tom's very nervous on the boat, especially when he's struggling with the jib, turning that rope. So he's terrified of the water. And so you get to see that in multiple times in the film, this little character trait. And however, ironically, this discomfort is constantly pushing against him because so many sequences and scenes in this film find himself near water.
Yeah, and you can argue that Freddy coming to Mungibello obviously loses his time and connection with Dickie because Freddy's getting his favor. And a lot of that's to do with water as well, because on the yacht, Tom doesn't go swimming, but Dickie and Freddy do. And you can maybe assume that if Tom knew how to swim and wasn't afraid and he was swimming with them, then maybe they all would have gotten along. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe they all would have been the three best friends that ever.
Could have been a bonding moment.
Yeah, it could have been. To maintain his attention, to maintain Dickie's attention.
Mm-hmm. He also does find another way to latch on to Dickie and kind of make him slightly more dependent on keeping him around, and that's Silvana's death.
Silvana!
So obviously, Dickie knocks up Silvana, his local mistress, and because he refuses to help her out with money and even be a part of her life, she drowns herself in the water in the bay of Mungibello. Her body comes up from the water during that religious ceremony, and fortunately in front of the whole town. It's really a tragic moment. However, Tom knows that Silvana is knocked up, and he uses this as a ploy to maintain his relationship with Dickie. He senses that things are kind of going off the deep end. He's losing Dickie's desire to be around him. And so he comes up with this ploy. I'll take the fall. I'll take the blame. Someone has to take the blame because... that's how much I love you. You're a brother to me. I think that he did this because he was noticing that Dickie was starting to push him away. He's like, this is my last ditch effort to maintain a presence and a relationship with Dickie. I can take the fall for Silvana if it comes to that. And I can keep this big secret for Dickie. I can show him that he can trust me and that he can rely on me because I won't tell anyone about Silvana.
I think the latter is exactly right. However, how could Tom possibly know that Silvana's pregnant?
Good question.
It's impossible for her. I don't think Tom knew she was pregnant.
Oh no, it's because Dickie tells him.
Yes.
Yeah. It's after
that. Did you know she was pregnant?
Yeah, it's because Dickie tells him.
So
yeah.
There's no way Tom could know Silvana's pregnant because there's actually a big debate on whether she committed suicide or murder. Now the easiest
assumption, was murdered?
Or was murdered.
Uh-huh.
So either Silvana was committed suicide or was murdered. Easiest assumption is that Silvana killed herself, obviously, because if she went through the pregnancy, it would have been a massive scandal and embarrassment for her, her family, and her pregnancy. It would have caused what it would have caused in her community.
You know what that means in a place like this?
She's devoutly religious, like everyone in this town. She is engaged, so she has to be a virgin, you know, according to her community, her culture, to marry. You know, she has to be virgin married. Married.
Virgin married.
She's already engaged, too. So... I like how people might assume or think, oh, did Tom murder her to protect Dickie? Did he know about the pregnancy? I don't think there's any way that Tom knew about the pregnancy. And I don't think that he murdered Sylvana either. I think there's an easy way to disprove that rumor or a theory, because we see every dark deed of Tom Ripley. We see all the murders he commits. We see all of his lies. We see every little thing he does.
You're saying they don't keep anything secret from the audience.
They don't.
Yeah.
Exactly. So why would they keep Sylvana secret from the audience if Dickie killed her? If he killed her on a whim, not knowing she's pregnant. Oh, he's got to protect Dickie somehow.
Yeah.
I think that if he was going to kill Sylvana, they would have shown it.
Yeah.
I think that is how you disprove the theory that she was murdered by Dickie.
Yeah, the audience, the Mangella in the story, they don't keep anything from the audience regarding Tom. So that's absolutely true. I never thought that he killed her. I always believed that she committed suicide because he has nothing to gain from killing Sylvana at all. There's really no reason to.
Yeah.
So if that was the case, he would kill all of the other women he sleeps with.
Exactly, yeah.
So why didn't he kill the girl in Naples?
Exactly. So I think that it's a theory out there I see a lot, but I think it's easily disproved. But how about we take a moment and head to our intermission, because we're already 50 minutes into this episode.
So after the intermission, I actually have this fun thing. I want to rate the outfits of everyone.
That's great.
The Talented Mr. Ripley is famous for its style. And the costuming, obviously Oscar nominated, it's so good. So I want to do ratings of all the outfits.
Love it. Now, before we continue, the best way to support Raiders of the Lost Podcast is to become a patron at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Why would you want to become a patron?
Is that your Italian version?
No, it's not.
Anthony. You're like, Raiders of the Lost Podcast.
It's not all how I said it. I just did it with a little flair.
Flair.
Anyways, can I get back into why people should sign up for Patreon? Besides supporting your dumbass. Just kidding. You can support me as well with Patreon. But we get awesome perks to you guys, like access to the ad-free version of every single episode, so you can listen to this Ripley episode with no commercials or no ad breaks at all. You also get access to video messages, personalized messages, watch parties. You get access to our Discord community, which is private, only for patron members. You also get custom episodes, all kinds of great perks, free merchandise. So sign up today, because it's the only way we can do our show full-time. Thank you to all of our patrons around the world. You are integral to Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Thank you. Another great way to support the show is to leave those 5-star ratings and reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. These reviews help us get seen. They help us get charted and help us get discovered by new listeners every single day. They're super important. I know every podcast you listen to says it to you, but that's because it works. That's the best way to say it. But also, Apple reviews at 5,000 ratings of 5-star ratings, I will get a tattoo of Anthony's choosing. Maybe he'll put a Talented Mr. Ripley tattoo.
Jude Law's face on your back.
Golden God on my back. Another great way to support the show is just share us. Word of mouth is the best way for a podcast to grow organically. So share us with your family, friends, anyone you know who loves movies, send them our show.
This episode, of course, like always, is sponsored by our friends at MoviePosters.com, the number one place to get your posters online today. If you'd like to win a free movie poster from MoviePosters.com, all you have to do is leave us a comment on the YouTube episode of The Talented Mr. Ripley that enters you into the contest to win a free poster from MoviePosters.com. We're going to pick a winner in 1 week. So again, leave a comment in this Talented Mr. Ripley episode on YouTube to enter that free poster giveaway contest. And in the meantime, MoviePosters.com is by far the best place to get your movie posters. High quality prints, all sorts of sizes, framing, backlighting, anything for your poster needs. And they have a huge library of movies and TV shows to choose from for all of their posters. So again, go to movieposters.com and use our promo code Raiders10 right now. That's Raiders10 to get 10% off your order immediately.
All right, let's get into this intermission. Start the movie quote competition. You ready?
Ready.
You don't listen, do you? I don't think you ever really hear me. You just ask the same questions every week. How's your job? Are you having any negative thoughts?
All I have are negative thoughts.
Joker. That was good. All right, here's my quote. I love the way this country smells. I'll never forget it. It's kind of spicy.
What the fuck? What is that? I don't know.
You're going to knock yourself. You want me to say it again?
I love the way... Say it one more time.
I love the way this country smells. I'll never forget it. It's kind of spicy.
I have no idea.
Darjeeling Limited.
Oh.
In it's Owen Wilson's character.
It's good. All right, Anthony. Movie release year time. What year did Tron come out?
1984.
82.
Damn it.
I'm Tron.
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 What year did The Village come out?
2005?
2004. Nice try. Nice try.
Okay. Pop quiz time. How many Oscars has Frances McDormand won, and what are the films she won for?
She's won three. Fargo, Three Billboards, and Nomadland.
Correct on the movies. However, she's won four.
Oh, is it for acting?
No, those are her three actings.
Okay. So she's won another Oscar. Can you tell me what the category was for?
Best Picture.
Best Picture. I'm going to go with Nomadland.
Yes, she was a producer of Nomadland.
Good job. Thanks, man.
Nice job.
Good question.
Thanks.
All right, here's my quiz. What movie did Adrian Brody and Keira Knightley star in together?
Adrian Brody and Keira Knightley in a movie together?
They're the two leads. I can give you a hint if you'd like a hint.
Give me a sec.
Think about it. Think about it, hero.
In honor of Spider-Man being back in theaters. Green Goblin, Spider-Man 1. Keira Knightley, Adrian Brody in a movie together. Oh my God, I'm drawing a blank on this one, man.
I'll just tell you.
Tell me.
The DMA. Jacket.
DMA. The Jacket.
The Jacket.
Damn.
Pretty good little horror movie.
That's cool. All right, Anthony. Do we have any haters this week or unsubscribes? What do we got?
What do we sure with? Do.
How are we cooking?
First up, we got Vinal Bridglag.
That was a weird.
Sorry. Sorry, Vinal.
Sound coming out of your mouth. Bridglag.
They're a Patreon member, too. Fuck.
Sorry. Way to go, Anthony. That was Anthony.
Sorry, pal. Typos. Unsubscribed. I put some photos on Patreon of a shooting the other day.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote, we shit something cool. When I meant to write, we shot something cool.
That's pretty funny.
And then Darian Wallace wrote, no photos of the shit.
No photos of the shit. That's hilarious.
Oh my God. I wrote, it was too grisly, trust me.
That's hysterical.
All right, next up.
No photos of the shit.
Decapasaurus wrote, Silver Surfer was not the villain of the Fantastic Four movie years ago. It was Galactus. Unsubscribed!
Was it? I guess we were wrong.
I think that Silver Surfer, if I remember now, was like, we thought they were the villain until they ended up being like, trying to save everyone from the Galactus. Yeah. Thanks,
copy.
Pal.
Copy.
Nathan Fielder wrote, guys, again with the buckets! P.S. Unsubscribed.
The real Nathan Fielder?
No. Next up, Royal Ren. Hey, Ren.
Hey, Ren.
So she put a certain timestamp of us talking about the French film Le Diabolique, but we kept saying, as she said, Le Diabolique, laugh. It's Le Diabolique, unsubscribed. Yes, we are bozos.
We prefaced that with, please be nice to us as we attempt to pronounce French words.
We were doing half the word American and half the word French by saying Diabolique.
Yeah, La Diabolique.
La Diabolique.
La Diabolique.
This is a really great French film.
American.
Bill Forteth.
La Diabolique. Budweiser.
La Diabolique is Bill Forteth.
Bill Forteth, yeah. La Diabolique. La Diabolique. All right.
Vic Matthews wrote, you guys said Metzia twice. Unsubscribed. What was that?
I don't remember. It's just a funny comment.
Horror movies episode.
Metzia. What would that been?
Vic, you're going to have to specify. I can't remember.
We need some context here.
All right, Isaiah wrote, another great episode watching from Australia, and the episode cut out from 35 minutes to 37 minutes. Weird. Might have to unsubscribe due to those terrible Australian accents. We did Megatron Australian.
Megatron Australian. Oh, it's a movie news episode cut out.
It's Optimus Prime Australia because Chris Hemsworth's playing it.
Did you fix it?
What?
The episode?
The episode's fine. It was just a problem with them watching it.
I'm Optimus Prime. I'm Optimus Prime.
All right.
Actually, that was pretty good.
Anthony Kern wrote, just wanted to shout out these guys for real. I was fortunate enough to be the winner of the movie poster contest, and it just arrived in the mail a few days ago. They aren't lying when it says top quality. Thank you, Anthony and James, for being accommodating and helpful during the whole process. Keep up the great work, guys. Can't wait to get a nice frame to hang up my brand new high-quality Jurassic Park movie poster.
And thank you to movieposters.com for providing that poster. Congratulations on winning. Use our coupon code Raiders10 today.
Next up, Evan Smith wrote, no hot rod stunt making the list. Unsubscribe.
Actually, yeah.
Life's short until it isn't. Life's short stunted. Sorry, Evan. You I could there, not bro? Read that. It was a hashtag, so all the letters were together.
We should have done the cliff roll. So funny.
Yeah, that's great.
So funny.
Shay Soap wrote, the podcast hosts fail at their own metric of success. We were talking about movies being good for being small in scope or simple, and we kept like going back and forth. However, they have sexy down. 2 out of 3 unsubscribed. Thanks, pal. Thanks, Shay.
Appreciate that, Shay.
That's everyone. Funny stuff, everyone. Thank you.
We have a great 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts from T Young 44 $. W Pod.
Aw.
Then they wrote, my goats. That's it.
Thanks, pal. Short
perfect
and sweet.
Review. My goats.
Short and sweet.
Thank you. That if you don't know, that means greatest of all time. Goats. Baby goats.
I think everyone knows what goat means.
Well, not everyone, maybe.
Are you going to say not everyone's me?
Not everyone's from America or from the UK. You know?
It's everyone knows what it is now, by now, I think. It's been seen enough in culture.
We'll see. We'll see. All right, Anthony, what is your streaming recommendation for this episode?
Lost in Translation is now on Max. Great watch.
I picked a movie on Max as well.
What was it?
American Sniper.
You're pointing a lot.
It's a banger.
Banger.
Get it? Bang, bang.
Oh, I got it.
Clint Eastwood, baby.
Clint.
Has great tactical stuff, too. It's a really well-made movie.
You know that movie made almost $600 million?
It was a big hit.
$25 million budget.
All right, let's get back to the talented Mr. Ripley. And how about we get to the murder?
Well, we were going to do the
rating outfits. You want to rank outfits.
Then we'll get to murder.
Okay,
let's have a little fun first.
Hold on, keep talking. I'm going to turn the AC down. We're getting a little cold.
Okay, so talented Mr. Ripley obviously is famous not just for its incredible setting and locations, but the styling and costuming and the wardrobe of this film are top tier. This movie is lived on the test of time. People still use it as influence when they're putting outfits together, and it's still synonymous with culture to this day. It's one of the most stylish films ever made. Now, I put together a list of outfits for the three main characters, and I want to rate their outfits
out
of 10. So we can give them ratings.
Let's hear this, man.
All right, we'll start with Dickie. So Dickie's dark blue suit, black button-up, and then the black hat he wears.
Ooh, it's sharp.
Yeah, I'm giving it a 10 out of 10.
9 out of 10.
Why not a 10 out of 10?
Because it's not the best outfit in the movie, and I don't want to give...
Okay.
I want to give that a 10 out of 10.
All right. Brown belt, too, by the way. Looks great. Next up, he has the outfit that I'm actually imitating. He has the black short sleeve button-up with white pants and black loafers.
9 out of 10.
9 out of 10.
Stylish as fuck.
9 out of 10. Also, that shirt is a little see-through linen. Looks great. All right, next up, we have the cream suit he wears in Naples.
Ooh.
In the jazz club.
Vestite.
Battistone. Which is actually a real
store.
Taylor, yeah.
8 out of 10.
I'm going to give the cream suit 8 out of 10, too. It was probably a 10 out of 10 in the era. All right, next up, we have the knit polo with the short shorts and the flats, the sailing flats.
Which knit polo? Which color?
The the gray with the pink shorts.
8 out of 10.
I give it a 8 out of 10 as well. Next up, we have the Rome suit, which is a cream jacket, blue tie, and blue shirt with dark navy pants and the black loafers.
8.5.
I give it a 9 out of 10.
8.5.
Because that tie is real nice.
It's a nice tie.
And then finally, we have the yellow knit button-up with white linen pants and white shoes. And this is the button-up where he only buttons one button.
10 out of 10.
I give this look, I give it a 10 out of 10 as well.
This is the look, man.
It's a great
and
look.
This is the shirt that Tom almost takes after he kills Dickie.
It's the yellow knit.
He hesitates with it.
All right, next up we have Marge, who has a lot of great looks. She wears a really elegant blue dress at the opera. I give this dress a 9 out of 10.
I will give it...
Shoulderless.
Yeah.
Silk.
Looks like Cinderella.
But a nice dark blue.
8.5 out of 10.
They smartly dressed her in a lot of blues to go with her eyes. She also likes to wear floral skirts with white button-ups casually. She wears two variations of that outfit, so I put them together as one outfit. I give that an 8 out of 10. Nice summer look. Then we have the blue knit coat in Venice. very sharp when she first arrives.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Tom, you're here?
I love how she loves Peter, and then she goes, Tom.
She lets him kiss her.
Yeah.
She's
like so creeped out by him.
8 out of 10.
I agree to 9 out of 10. I think it's really slick. Then she wears a brick-colored sundress with a white top with lunch with Dickie and Tom. I give this look a 9 out of 10.
Great like summer look. I'm going to go 9 out of 10, too.
And then the leopard print coat and hat, matching hat in Venice.
Ooh, that's a nice one. 9.5.
I give it an 8 out of 10.
It's classy.
Yeah. Not my type. Not my style. And then finally, Tom, who goes through a wardrobe transformation. First up, corduroy jacket in Rome. Rating.
Corduroy jacket in Rome. Oh, Tom.
Corduroy jacket.
I was just
the
telling
scenes.
Dickie. Let me get this straight. You wear Dickie's clothes, you eat his food, you live in his house, and his dad picks up
the tab.
Let me know if you can't do this anymore. I'll do it. I'll do it. 4 out of 10.
Corduroy jacket, 3 out of 10. All right, neon green swim trunks.
Oh my god. 1 out
Tidy
of 10
whiteys.
1 out of 10
0 out of 10 for me. 0 out of 10.
It's a Speedo, Anthony. Speedo, no, sorry.
I couldn't think of the name.
Whitey. You just said neon green whitey tighties.
I was just trying to illustrate with the
Speedo.
Yeah. They cover as much as a whitey tighty. Terrible look. All right, next up, Tom coming into his own with the black turtleneck.
I like the black turtleneck. Suits him. I'm going to give it 8.5 out of 10.
I agree. I think the black turtleneck is a really good look for his transformation, not into Dickie, but into the new version of Tom.
I know you love opera, but would you absolutely hate if I dragged you to the... I know you love jazz. What'd she say?
No, I know you absolutely... You loathe opera.
I know you're a jazz man, but...
I know you're a jazz fiend.
Yeah.
But would you absolutely hate it if I dragged you to the opera?
You can drag me.
You can drag me. Exactly. Then we have the really sharp brown suit he wears.
Oh, that one's 10 out of 10.
That's a great suit. Really goes well with Matt Damon's hair and skin tone, so I give that a 9.5 out of 10. And then we have the cream cashmere polo he wears when Freddy shows up.
7 out of 10.
I give that an 8 out of 10.
It's nice.
Yeah.
7, though.
But for loungewear, that's
it's
nice.
It's nice
loungewear. Yeah. He's just chilling by himself.
7.5.
Yeah. And then we have Freddy's Rome outfit.
It's so bad.
I give it a 10 out of 10. It suits him perfectly.
Because he's such a douche. Yeah. I mean, it fits his personality, but it's a 6 out of 10 for me.
Glasses, sunglasses, 10 out of 10 as well.
If I'm late, think what his wife's thinking. God, did you want to fuck everyone at least once?
No, if I'm late, think what her husband's thinking.
No, I was doing the Rome one.
Yeah. Only once.
Ciao bello.
All right. Let's go into the murder.
Yeah, let's get into the murders here because this movie gets cooking as soon as Dickie gets killed by Tom in San Remo. So they're in San Remo because Dickie needs a change of scenery. You know, he says so horribly, like with everything at Manji, you know, basically saying Sylvana's
like he's the victim.
Yeah, like Sylvana's suicide. You know, with everything going on, like I need to get out of there. Such a dick. Such a pompous asshole.
You can't help but love him still.
And so he's moving to San Remo, which is a little north, and he takes Tom up. Our last trip!
First place I saw, I got it.
Got it. They take the boat out. And I again, here, this is after they go to the jazz festival, and I think Tom has seen an opportunity to continue their relationship, or he thinks that Dickie has maybe sort of opened up to him because he's admitting truths to him.
During the performance, when he's, like, enjoying the drums, yeah.
But then, because Tom is making plans without Dickie that Dickie doesn't want to be a part of, then Dickie gets annoyed, you know? He's like, what if I come back to Italy? To Italy? Really? Why? Why would you want to come back?
And Jude does a perfect job of playing someone who's, like, not interested in, like, this is not what I want to be hearing right now. Tom's not catching the hint I'm giving him.
It's like, what if you have a place here and I have a place in Rome, or we get a place together and we can split.
When we're there, we're there.
When we're here, we're here.
Also, sorry, at that performance, when Dickie says, what do you think about the drums? So cool. It's a perfect parallel for him changing people.
Yeah.
He goes from sax to drums, just like how he goes from like Freddy to Fausto to Tom.
Wow. What a great correlation, Anthony.
That's why I get paid the big bucks, man.
The medium bucks. Unless you sign up for Patreon, then patreon.com will help us get the big bucks.
Oh, yeah.
/ Raiders of the Lost Podcast.
So you're going on about.
And then he says, but there's just one issue, you know, like the Marge problem. He's like, I'm marrying Marge. What are you talking about? And they get in their back and forth arguments. And then Dickie becomes very annoyed with Tom. Dickie calls Tom boring, and you're boring to be around. Dick, I can't move without your leech.
And also, he didn't realize that all these moments that meant nothing to Dickie meant the world to Tom.
Like the bathtub scene. Like, what night are you talking about?
Yeah.
And he's laughing like, about bathtub? It. And him and Marge fucking in the yacht. So Tom is coming out with this like big confession about how he's been honest with him completely from the start about his feelings, trying to send signals because he's been hinting to Dickie that he loves him a lot. You know, he says with the letter from Francis, oh, stop telling me how much you love Dickie. And he's like, I'm falling in love with the way you live. It's all one big love affair. He says all these lines about love, about Dickie, hinting to him that he's falling in love with him and becoming infatuated with him.
Dickie didn't hear the word love the first time while the band was playing.
Yeah.
He says, all one big love affair, but Dickie was too distracted by the drums to even hear him say that word.
And so Tom lashes out and grabs the oar and hits Dickie in the face, then eventually kills him. And it's intense. It's so well done. It's shocking. It's horrifying.
Dude, every time I watch it, that oar hit, I'm just like, oh my God.
And then the great blood and prosthetics on Jude Law's face. It looks terrific. Pulling out.
It's such a shame he did that to that face.
And then he kills I know, right? He kills Dickie, and then he cuddles Dickie's body. It's the first time he's been able to lay with him. You know, he's tried to, and why do you always do that thing on trains when he obviously notices that Tom like turns towards him on trains and uses the reflection to pretend to be his lover or to pretend to be him in the reflection.
I think so you're talking about the shot when they're on the train going north to San Remo. And then Tom, while Dickie's sleeping, he looks at the reflection, and it's a profile of Dickie, and Tom is looking towards Cam, towards the glass, and their faces are overlapping. I think it's a moment where Tom notices we actually look pretty similar. That's what I think that moment is. Yeah. But he does have this thing on trains. Spook. But I love the boat scene. It's so impactful. And that shot of him holding Dickie in the boat, like you said, it's his. He's finally has a moment to hold him. It's what he's wanted more than anything, because the bathtub scene was really a big test for Tom, where he says, hey, I'm cold. Can I get in into the warm bath? And then Dickie says no. He doesn't want to share a bath with him. And then Tom says, I didn't mean with you in it. So he failed right there. Obviously, he did mean with Dickie in it. He wanted to share the bath with him. And so this is another ploy. This is like a last-ditch effort for him. And then after killing him, this is really the only time, the only opportunity Tom's ever going to have to, in a way, be intimate with Dickie in terms of holding him. And you can imagine, like, he held him there for hours, just slept with him, something he's always desired to do. And then after that, he dumps the body. And that's one of my favorite shots of the film is the overhead first. It's a close-up overhead. Well, not a close-up, but a medium, where the boat fills the entire frame as it's panning across. And then they cut to a, they actually dissolved, cross-dissolved to a very wide overhead shot of the same thing. It's a really incredible cut.
And then what happens? Tom's panicking. He sinks the boat with Dickie's body inside of it, and he goes to the hotel soaking wet. And what happens at the hotel? The concierge thinks he's Dickie.
Senor Greenleaf?
And just like with borrowing a jacket, with the Princeton jacket, with Herbert Greenleaf, he doesn't say, no, I'm not Dickie. No, I didn't go to Princeton. Oh, he doesn't say it in the scene, but we can assume he said, oh, yeah, I am Dickie Greenleaf.
And
he begins to become Dickie.
And he comes up with the really incredible plan. So he has to do multiple things. He has to create a correspondence between Tom and Dickie to prove that Dickie was alive past this day.
Also, he moves to Rome, which is where he wanted to move.
Yeah, exactly. So he moves to Rome, checks into two hotels. One hotel is Tom.
Goldoni.
The Goldoni. And then he moves into an upper-class hotel as Dickie and creates a correspondence between the two of them over several days to prove, like a paper trail, that Dickie survived past that sailing day. At the same time, he's manipulating Marge. He brings back the perfume, and inside was the typewritten letter. Learning that Dickie types his letters was huge for Tom. And he points that out immediately when he first sees Dickie typing the first letter.
Do you always type your letters?
So that allows him to be able to, he doesn't have to worry about forging his penmanship, although he probably could, but typing it obviously makes it so easy. All he really has to do is forge the signature, which he can do no problem.
It's an easy signature to forge, yeah.
Yeah, and so he creates this incredible manipulation story of him breaking up with Marge and saying he's going to live in Rome. And Marge believes it, and it crushes her and deflates her and defeats her. However, Tom knows her so well, he knows that she won't go confront Dickie, at least not for a while, because she knows that Dickie doesn't like being confronted. So he's created these two, he's created all these steps to elude any kind of evidence that he committed any kind of crime. However, he does run into some trouble when Freddie Miles shows up.
Yeah, when Freddie Miles shows up to his place in Rome, and he actually pretty smartly tracks him from the American Express store.
Some kid.
And this is one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie, because we get to see Tom, what he would do with wealth. And he's decorated this apartment, which is in Rome, where he wants to live. And he has a completely different style than Dickie.
He's been shopping with Meredith.
Yeah, he's been shopping with Meredith. He has this bust that he's obsessed with. And he has this Christmas scene. He's got Christmas by himself, alone, opening presents he got himself. That's crazy.
Chestnuts roasting by the fire.
It's like everything you ever wanted. You get to see it. He's got a grand piano in there. He's playing piano, plucking away.
Pluck, 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 pluck.
And then Freddie shows up, and he's got the ring on. He's got to take it off. That's the first instance where the ring comes into play. And this is a situation where, you know, Freddie's an idiot, but he's not completely lost. And he sees what's going on, and he's grilling Tom. He's threatening him in a lot of ways. But he says, there's something going on here. And he also says, the only thing that looks like Dickie is you.
You've done something with your hair.
Are you living here?
And if it's not super clear how Freddie tracked him, like you said, it was the American Express store, which we see multiple times and they go to multiple times. But also Freddie says this other small line, he says some kid. So he got some kid to get Tom's information through the American Express store, not him personally. So that's how he was able to track where Tom's paper trail led him to this apartment.
And Tom's panicking, you know, he's trying to tell his lies, but they're not working. They're not working on Freddie because Freddie knows something's up. If you said lunch, I'd believe you.
Maybe if you said he's still at lunch, I might believe you.
Yeah. And obviously, what's Tom got to do? He has to kill Freddie. Kills Freddie. It's the only way to keep his con going and to hide the fact that he's actually murdered Dickie and that Dickie is dead. This is the only other person that knows that anything's going on, so that's why he kills Freddie.
I have a really cool fact about the marble bust that he uses to kill Freddie.
Let's hear it.
So obviously he bashes in Freddie's head with the bust, which falls out of his hands and then chips off a part of its nose. That is a bust of Emperor Hadrian. Hadrian had an obsessive affair with the Greek ruler Antoninus, who died under mysterious circumstances while sailing, possibly killed by the emperor in one of his famous fits of anger.
Interesting.
Ties very much to
Tom.
Cool
anecdote.
Yeah.
Now this sets off, obviously Dickie was the first murder, but now he's setting off a spree of murders to completely...
We get our Weekend at Bernie scene.
Weekend at Bernie scene, carrying a dead body to the car. And then obviously he's under investigation because he was the last person to have been seen with Freddie Miles when Freddie was alive. He was seen, but no one will. He's very lucky. He was seen bringing the body to a car, but that man will not testify because he was with another man's woman. So he won't testify in court. So Tom gets so lucky, but he's doing a great job of playing both identities until he's about to give up. You know, even when he runs into Marge, and he's like, I'll take you to Dickie. He's around here somewhere.
The gymnastics of it.
Yeah. He's about to give in. He's with the inspector, and
he's getting pushed by them, and Marge is at the door.
He's like, you know
he's
what?
He's like, fuck it.
Let her in.
What's the difference?
Fuck it, man. It's over. But he's like, wait. I can get out of this. I can fix this. And then he figures out what to do, basically. He starts to improvise even more. He'll have a new meeting with the investigator tomorrow. But he gets very lucky. You know, he decides to abandon the identity of being Dickie Greenleaf. Scratches out the passport photo.
Writes the suicide note.
Suicide note.
Gets the license plates.
And that brilliant shot on the piano doors as he closes the top. The reflection. Oh, my God. Chef's
what a picture.
It's the
piano holster cover over the keys. And the curve in that part of the instrument, the reflection of Tom as he steps away. So at first he's right above the piano and you see his reflection in his head. As he steps back, his reflection splits into two reflections. And it's just an amazing moment of the film with that theme playing from Gabriel Yared. Like, oh my God, what a great shot.
But speaking of gymnastics, to even go, we fast forward a little bit in terms of plot and structure here. We missed where the opera scene where Tom's in Rome and then he's courting Meredith while he's in Rome, pretending to be Dickie, and they go to the opera together. And this is a great scene as well. Great location, great production design. He bumps into Marge and Peter Smith Kingsley. Have you met him? He's wonderful. And what I love about the scene is Tom, even though he's with Meredith, he's always looking for opportunities. And he sees an opportunity here with Peter. He's clearly attracted to Peter. He flirts with Peter a little bit. He rubs his arm when he says, "It was nice to meet you." And even Peter flirts back, "I was rather looking to rowing you around in my boat or something."
They basically
like that.
Fucked each other with their eyes.
Yeah, they did. They eye fucked the shit out of each other. But he's created an opening here.
Yeah.
And he's gotten out with Peter. Like, if something happens here, I can move to this other person to continue on. But that's a great bit of gymnastics where he's Dickie with Meredith, but then he has to pretend he's Tom with Marge and Peter.
No glasses?
In the same stairwell. It's really great gymnastics. It's awesome.
Then
he sets up the great plan where they leave the opera early, and the genius plan at the Spanish Steps the next day, the two cafe dates where he sets up a date with Meredith
to end things as
Dickie to officially end things in person, and then he sets up himself as Tom with Marge and Peter, and it so brilliantly works where they bump into Meredith, and then they kind of talk about themselves to make it seem like Dickie's still alive.
And to see in 10:30, 10:15,
and
it's a really fantastic sequence, and it's brilliant. And it's again him thinking on his feet because he already planned to meet Marge and Peter at 10:30, and to have Marge go there at 10:15 and wait for him there. It's just a brilliant out for him to escape the moment as Dickie and then still show up there as Tom. And he does a great job of constantly making Tom look innocent and unawares of what's even going on. And also he's constantly using Tom, the identity of Tom, as a way of maintaining Dickie's presence somewhere by saying, "Oh, I just saw Dickie. I'll bring it to Dickie. Oh, I don't believe that." So he uses his persona as Tom to trick Marge into thinking that Dickie's still alive as well.
And then because he's abandoned Dickie and now he's Tom again, he can escape Rome. He escapes Rome and he goes to Venice, and he decides he has to get questioned by a detective. So he's like, "I'll do it in Venice because different jurisdictions, basically, in
different
the country.
Detective will talk to me."
And so it's a smart plan, but it backfires almost. But because
he thought he was going to be the same inspector
Roverini
as Rome, even though he was that guy thinks he's Dickie. So
exactly.
This is an investigation for Tom.
There's another situation of Tom just being so lucky.
Yeah.
They don't send the detective that let Dickie escape Rome. Instead, they send some other detective who isn't up to speed completely on the case, but he's up to speed on some of the details, but he doesn't know what Tom looks like. And clearly, if they had sent the other detective, the jig would have been up.
He'd be fucked.
Another situation of how lucky Tom Ripley is.
And it's just because the Rome police were very unhappy with that previous inspector.
Yeah, and so he abandons that con. Now he's got a new situation with Peter. He's got an apartment that Peter set him up with.
I think that this sequence with Peter is where Tom really flourishes as himself. And he doesn't have to pretend. He's not pretending to be Dickie around like he does with Meredith. He's being Tom, but with Peter, I have this thing with this movie, and I do think that Tom really does love Peter. And I think that he opens up to Peter, and he has a deep connection to Peter. And I think that there's this great scene where they're talking in Peter's apartment, and they talk about the key and the basement. And Tom almost tells Peter who he is, who he really is. I think he was very close to telling him. I think he would have if things hadn't gone sour by the end of the film, but I do think that Tom has an intense connection and desire to be with Peter from the moment they first made eye contact at the opera all the way to spending so much time together. And the greatest tragedy of this movie, and it is tragic, is when Tom is basically forced to kill Peter at the end of the film because Meredith saw him on the boat. Because Peter's the only person who actually recognizes good qualities in Tom. Marge turns sour to Tom pretty quickly. Meredith doesn't know Tom Ripley technically. She just only sees the Dickie persona. And then obviously Dickie rejected Tom eventually. So Peter's the only person who has spent time with Peter and gotten to know Tom, and has actually grown to enjoy and in a way love Tom for his qualities. That has never happened to Tom before at all in his life. Peter's the first person to ever accept him.
Yeah, I'm not completely sold on the idea or the belief that Tom's in love with Peter. I've always looked at it like this is just another person to get close to con, to keep jumping from lily pad to lily pad. He's like a toad, lily pad to lily pad to lily pad. Each person's a lily pad. I feel like he's conning and playing Peter, but I could be wrong.
I just think the reaction after strangling Peter solidifies it.
Yeah, I guess, because it's similar to Dickie, where after he does it, it's an emotional one for him, because you can assume that if he got to kill Marge, which he tries to do, he tries to kill Marge after she finds Dickie's ring, and, you know, Dickie promised her he'd never take it off. Why do you have Dickie's rings? And then, Marge, I'm naked. Please let me get dressed. I think that probably if he killed Marge, it wouldn't have been as emotional for him.
No way.
But I think it's because he's attracted to Peter, too. I don't know if he loves him, though. I think
he's... Or maybe he just loves that Peter loves him.
I don't know if they love each other. Mm-hmm. I think they're attracted to each other and they like each other. Yeah. I think it's too quick for them to be in love with each other. But I think that he really likes Peter. But I think that he's just using Peter and tapping into things that will get Peter on his side.
Also, Peter is really his last chance to be Tom Ripley forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he loses that at the end of the film. He says, I'm going to be stuck in the basement forever, right before he kills him. What he's saying is he's never going to be able to be Tom. He's going to have to be this grifter forever, bouncing around between personas. Yeah, and he'll never be able to just be himself.
It's obviously clear that Tom is in the closet homosexual, and he's obviously attracted to men. He falls in love with Dickie, wants to be Dickie's infatuated with him. And obviously infatuated with Peter, and homosexuality, it's an undertone in this film. And obviously in Italy, there's a couple sequences of homosexuality where we have the detective out of nowhere asks Tom if he's a homosexual. And Peter says, interesting, non sequitur. Officially in Italy, there are no homosexuals. And then there's also a shot when
on the street.
Tom is exploring Rome by himself, and he sees two gay men, one man on another man's lap playing with his tie. So I think that, and Mangella obviously put this in there on purpose, but I think obviously that's what Tom is. He's a closet homosexual. He's afraid to show who he truly is.
Definitely. So I think that with Peter Smith Kingsley, it was his opportunity. This is me. I can be Tom Ripley and live the life I've always wanted with Peter. That's possible with Peter. But then when Meredith shows up, it makes it an impossibility. It'll never happen.
I love the scene where Tom tries to kill Meredith. I mean, tries to kill Marge with the razor blade.
The best.
It's so incredible. And you see he's got the switch blade. He's got the blade in his knife and in his hand.
I feel like you haven't listened to a word I said.
I love you, Marge. I always have. Put that in your pocket.
Write that on a note. Put it in your pocket.
Tom loves me. Save it for a rainy day. And it's great because it's a way for him to get close proximity to her, as well as the locked door. But, you know, Tom isn't out of the woods yet. He's still trying to figure out, but he does get out of the woods when Herbert comes with an inspector, and they're on the case. They're trying to find Dickie.
In America, they teach us to look into facts before they become facts.
Exactly, and Tom is saved in a lot of ways by Herbert. He's saved by the inspector because Herbert takes Tom's side. He trusts Tom for some reason. Tom was always like a nice guy to him, but he trusts Tom. He's like, you've been nothing but a good friend to my son.
You've been a good friend to my son.
And he believes the suicide note. He believes that Dickie did something to himself, because we eventually learn that Dickie has a dark past. He put a guy in a hospital for beating the crap out of him. That's why he went to Europe. His father sent him away to save him from prosecution, save him from going to jail. And because of this, Herbert and the inspector assume that he did take his own life.
And did kill Freddy.
Did kill Freddy, and that he has a violent past. He has a temper. He's done bad things in his past. So Dickie's dark past hides Tom's trail of evidence. It's so lucky.
And he even gets Dickie's money.
He gets part of his inheritance. And, you know, Herbert says to the inspector, which he relates to Tom, Mr. Herbert believes that there was a hidden promise inside Dickie's letter to you. And he intends to honor that. And so Dickie, for the rest of his life, will get a portion. Tom, for the rest of his life, will get a portion of Dickie's inheritance.
Yeah.
He's set. It's incredible. And I like how you said earlier that Tom goes through immense transformation in this film. He does, but inside, because the movie starts with him in his dorky attire, his bad clothing, becomes Dickie, has great style, great expensive clothing, gets rid of that identity, ends up back with his lame, poor clothing, again, which is
Meredith almost didn't recognize him.
Yeah, which is what he's wearing with the glasses on, in Venice. But his eyes are totally different. His demeanor, his even his posture seems different. Even though he looks exactly how he looked at the beginning of the movie, mm-hmm. now he's a completely different person on the inside.
Yeah, and this trust, the income that he gets from the Greenlee family will help him in the future stories written by Patricia Highsmith as a bouncing off point. And this, by the end of the film, with this income, this is going to allow him to enter that world he always wanted to be in, although he's not really going to be able to be himself ever, he's learned.
I know. And it's got a great conclusion, this film, because it sets up even more. It's tragic how Tom can't just live now. It's tough to say it's tragic because he's a killer, but he just has to keep killing.
Yeah.
He can't stop. He has to keep covering his trail. It's a never-ending chain because he's on this boat with Peter because he's going to go help him with his performances in Greece.
Things couldn't be better.
It's perfect. He steps outside for some air for the sunset with Peter, and Peter goes inside. And who's he bump into? Meredith with her family.
Lots of co. You spotted me. You get the reward.
What?
She's like, what the fuck?
So this is tough for Tom because he lies to her saying that he obviously she knows him as Dickie and that he's undercover. He's in hiding. And Tom has to make a decision. Do I kill Meredith or do I kill Peter?
You can't kill Meredith because she's with her family.
And he got spotted.
Yeah.
He cannot kill Meredith.
Multiple people saw Dickie on that boat.
Exactly. So what's he have to do? He has to kill Peter. But what's he do before he goes and kills Peter? He kisses Marge. He puts on the charm and kisses Marge like he never did before.
Yeah.
And
she swoons immediately.
Yes. So he grabs a hold. So he jumps from one lily pad. He was on this new lily pad with Peter. Now he's back on the Meredith lily pad.
And you can assume somewhere in the future when he's with Meredith, someone's going to spot him who knows him as Tom.
He's going to have to kill her. But the end kill scene of Peter is so good. It's so well made, so well directed. And again, like I said in the beginning of the episode, we get a confession from Tom. One of the most honest things he said, how he said, I always thought it would be better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody. He is a real nobody, but for a time, he has been a fake somebody. And that's who he'll always be.
And we don't see the act of strangling. It's a great moment of off-screen violence. And what they did is, we saw him tighten his grip on the scarf. We know he's going to use that as the weapon. He lies down on Peter Smith Kingsley as Peter's going off on good qualities about Tom. You're such a liar. Tom is beautiful. Such a liar. And then it cuts to Tom entering his cabin, horribly in despair. He sits down in the chair beside the wall. And with audio and sound design, we hear the strangling of Peter Smith Kingsley, knowing that this just happened, and him going into the room by himself is the aftermath. And then we get to that opening shot of the great tracking shot encircling Tom's face, and it goes from the right side of his face, which is lit up by the window, and it tracks all the way around to the left side of Tom's face, which is silhouetted in black and shadow, showing the darkness has overwhelmed him. And then it cuts to the best shot in the film, and that is the wandering reflections from both the door's mirror as well as the bathroom mirror. And then the door mirror is moving back and forth from the waves of the ship. And we get to see this incredible, beautiful display of reflections, the split persona, the psyche in disarray, and the tragedy unfolding. And then the door slowly closes to black.
Brilliant, brilliant ending to a wonderful movie.
What a picture.
What a picture.
I have some fun trivia to say.
Let's hear it, man.
Jude Law learned how to play the saxophone for this film, and Matt Damon learned how to play the piano. However, Damon's training enabled him to create the proper keyboarding fingering technique. He wasn't actually playing it. And so the music heard in the film from Tom playing piano inside of rooms is actually played by Sally Heath and Gabriel Yared, who is the composer of the film as well. Also, Jude Law spent 2 months preparing for this movie. He said it was the best prep he ever did for a role because they sent him to Italy to get a tan and then to put on muscle by rowing. And so he stayed in Italy for a couple of months, ate great food, hanged out on the beach, rowed, and just chilled.
It's a pretty cool prep.
And it was the first huge, huge movie he was in.
Yeah.
And he was like, he just peaked in terms of like what you had to do for a movie. Also, this is Matt Damon's favorite film that he's ever made.
I think it would be my favorite movie ever if I was in it too.
Anthony Minghella originally wanted Tom Cruise for the role of Ripley, which could have been very good.
Yeah.
But after seeing Good Will Hunting, he decided to cast Matt Damon. Matt Damon personally lost 30 pounds for this role, playing Tom Ripley, and he achieved this by running 10 miles every morning, even during production, in order to keep his weight down. So whenever you see him shirtless, he's very gaunt and very skinny. And he wanted to create that. It wasn't part of the character or description, but he wanted to create that. And then after viewing this film, Tommy Wiseau was so emotionally moved that he vowed to make a film just as, if not more compelling, than The Talented Mr. Ripley. This film would famously become The Room.
Is that true?
It's true.
That's pretty great. That's incredible. Wow, I'm so glad we finally did an episode on this movie.
We saved it.
Man,
saved
it in the can. Saving this bacon in the freezer for a while.
I want to check out the Netflix show because I do love Andrew Scott, and Steve Zaillian has always been just a terrific screenwriter. So I'm curious about it.
Me too.
Well, but I love this movie. I love it.
Well, that wraps our episode on The Talented Mr. Ripley. I feel like I'm losing my voice. So yes. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to this one. It's a passionate one for us. And I know many of you listeners really adore this film as well. And I hope that we helped shed some new light on it and make you look at it in new ways. And
because really, it is a misunderstood film, I think. Yeah, an underappreciated film.
Yeah, underappreciated these days. I mean,
some films, they don't reveal themselves on the first watch. And so I think this is a movie that some people watch and like, oh, it was okay.
Yeah.
But for me, that was the case. And on rewatches, it's become one of my favorites.
Yeah. I was so excited to do this. And thank you so much for tuning in. Don't forget to become patrons at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Leave those 5-star ratings and reviews on Spotify and Apple. And be sure to share with your family and friends. Take care, everybody.
See you next time.
This episode was executive produced by our chosen one patrons, Cody Moen, Andrew Hagen, Becca Keen, Benjamin Cook, Calvin Murphy Griggs, Nicholas Martin, Darian Singleton, Tyler McFly, Andrew Hagen. Our chosen one patrons are our biggest supporters. Thank you so much. Raiders of the Lost Podcast is a Mirror Image production. Sound mixing done by Jacob Kosler. Opening music by Chase Jackson.